Welcome to the Casey Kowar Show, a celebration of words. And I'm delighted today to have as my guest Alice McDermott. We'll be discussing After This, which has just been published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. And first of all, Alice, thanks for taking time out of a busy schedule to talk with us.
Oh, I'm glad to do it.
Well, as in form of a disclaimer here, I'll tell you that Alice and I have known each other for a while, and we met at the Suwannee Writers Conference. And I'd like to dedicate this interview to Cherie Peters, who's a person that I think we both hold near and dear to our hearts. And I'd like this one to go out to Cherie and all that she does for aspiring writers and existing writers.
Absolutely. You're here.
So, Alice, when you started After This, the themes, it seems to me, and After This are bigger and broader in scope that you took on as a writer. And I can remember at some point in time talking to you about the difficulty of writing family dramas, because there has to be tension, there has to be conflict. And when you took on After This, you really deal with what we'll call big issues in this novel. And you kind of used foreshadowing as one of the stylistic techniques that you use. And if you would talk a little bit about the way you work as a writer. You've told me before that you consider yourself a slow writer, and you go through a lot of editing and drafts before you're happy with what you've done.
So yes, After This was particularly slow, even for me. I think the way I saw family in the novel from the very beginning was very much that idea of family as the first shelter. When I say shelter, I just don't mean shelter from the storm, which is sort of a literal scene, but just the place from which we gain our strength in order to move through our time on Earth. And as a place where we gather while sort of forces beyond our control influence and change our lives.
Mm-hmm. And Mary Keane, who's one of the protagonists, on the first page you use the phrase the march of time. And at the start of the book she's praying for contentment, not necessarily happiness, but just contentment, because she's 30 years old, she's by herself, and living at home with her father and her brother, and feeling quite alone in the world.
Yeah, and she sees, I think she has a job. She understands that, you know, it's not terrible, it's good enough. And I think she has the awareness even then that even as time marches on, which is a favorite phrase of hers, there's that sense of, see what you're doing, see what's before you, and it will get through. Another phrase she tells herself is, not so bad, the day wasn't so bad, got through it, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And just that sense, all right, not large things, I don't need to win $1 million, I don't need or believe that Prince Charming is going to come and transform my life, but just that sense of, get me through this, and that's her prayer.
Mm-hmm. And for those of us of the quote-unquote baby boom generation, the term I'm coming to dislike, maybe it's because I'm firmly entrenched in that, but I really think that After This has the maturity of being able to turn around and look back at life a little bit about what we expect out of our lives. And one of the characters I really like, and I have a feeling you did too, because she serves as a sounding board for Mary, is Pauline.
Yes.
And when you started the novel, people always ask me, you know, how do you become a writer, or how do you write? I would say read books like After This, and the character of Pauline is, it starts out, she's kind of a sounding board, but then she takes on a life of her own and becomes a very important part of the novel.
She does, yeah. Pauline is really begins just as an office mate of Mary's, and sort of a pain,
mm-hmm.
to put it mildly. very negative. Pauline sees the world very clearly, and Mary sees it very clearly too, but Mary's the one who's saying, not so bad, it could be worse, this is okay, I'm getting through this. Whereas Pauline is the one who says, not so bad, are you kidding? Did you see this? Look at this. Isn't that bad? Isn't that awful? Look at that toupee. Look at the worn spot on that guy's suit. Look who's having an affair in the office. She's very clear-eyed, but her eye goes to I wouldn't even say what's negative. It's just what perhaps indicates that this is not such a great deal we've got, this life we're all trying to get through. And so in many ways, Mary, I think, feels that in order to really justify her own optimism, she has to somehow bring Pauline along.
Mm-hmm.
Understand that Pauline is, as Mary calls her, you know, an unlikable person.
Mm-hmm.
But she's also the test of Mary's optimism.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and part of the part of your audience that you've accreted over the years it's much larger than that, but you write about Catholicism, and there's some wonderful humor in After This that I like, and it really is, I think, again, written with maturity of someone who can look back at all the changes in the church, and Mary Keene is of the generation where, you know, when Jesus said, feed my lambs, she takes that literally. And she's really a good person, and so's Pauline, and it's just really interesting when they arrive at certain points in their life, how they look back, and I think it's kind of a natural thing to say, should I have done this, should I have done that? You know, those are some of the things that some of the topics that you deal with in the novel.
Right, well, both Pauline and Mary are Catholic, so though Pauline, again, as Mary says, is not on speaking terms with the church, she's not on speaking terms with a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
Among the people she finds have somehow failed her, she's somewhat estranged from the church. But I think for both of them, and this is certainly Mary's refrain, and for me what much of what the novel is about, is that the church, not so much as institution, not so much as what it consists of rules and rituals, but a place that gives language to their petitions. Mary starts out praying, really. That's what begins the book. Help me to get through this. Help me to be content. And prayer is a huge theme throughout the novel. It's repeated by various characters at various times, time and time again. And again, it's not the institutional church and things like eating meat on Friday or not eating meat on Friday, but it's the place that gives the characters a language with which to express to the universe itself what it is they're longing for. And for me, that's sort of the organic part of the religious life of these characters. It's so much a part of them that the more technical details, although the church over the decades that the novel carries is changing tremendously, and Mary and her husband are not terribly happy with the modern changes. Their children are, in some ways, are estranged from the church because of the modern changes. But all that sort of runs on the surface of what their religion really does for them, and that is it gives them a language with which to express what it is they long for.
Mm-hmm. And one of the scenes that I loved in After This is when John Keene, Mary's husband, has to go out and raise money for the, as you say, for the physical construct of the new building. And it's a wonderful recreation of the struggle that a lot of Catholics were having at that point in time, where here they were, newly married, back from the war, barely able to make ends meet, and John Keene has to go to their homes dressed up to try to ask them for yet more money in a household which is strapped for cash to begin with.
Sure, and that's, you know, and that's the side of the church that they are at one on the one hand, very much involved in. He's doing the work of the church. He's on the building committee. And on the other hand, it's the side of the church that is not providing them with what they really need. The pastor who wants to tear down the old church, which is looking a little dilapidated, and raise a marvelous, modern, round church, which was very much in vogue in those days, in the 60s, eventually realizes that was a mistake. You know, it's sort of the institution is so human, and it's full of pride and misapprehensions and misunderstandings of what it is its people need, and it makes lots of mistakes because of that. And yet, underlying that, again, the sense of grace, the sense of a place to gather, to petition, to get through, remains the same.
Mm-hmm. And Alice, another character that I loved was Mr. Parachetti, who, and again, we're not going to give any of the plot details away. But he's another character that, as I, when I read the book the second time, I really saw he's a fascinating character as well, because he's a man who really takes on, you're able to talk a lot about the effect of war and what war does to people, and Mr. Parachetti is a great great character for you to give to give the novel the voice, point of view it has about warfare. And in this case, we're talking about Vietnam, but it could be any war in any era.
Yes, well, you know, I felt that way very strongly, that in two ways. One, that there are actually two wars that figure in the book. The first, that John Keane, the father, was involved in, the Second World War, during which he meets very briefly a young soldier who dies, but then he names Jacob, his firstborn son, after this soldier. Just, again, to not even sure why. He doesn't know this boy. He only, you know, spent a few hours with him. But in some, again, reconciling the suffering of the universe, some offer of saying, he says in his mind to this young soldier after he's learned he's died, what can I do for you? And years later, what he does is he simply names, he gives his son the name Jacob in honor of him. And then the second war that actually figures in the book is Vietnam. But yeah, it was very much my intention not to write a Vietnam novel. That's not for me. It's been done really well by many others. But just to give that sense of that cyclical, Nate, I mean, here's Second World War, there was Korea, Vietnam, and by extension, you could assume that some of the cousins or siblings of the Keane family may have children who ended up in Iraq. I mean, it's just that in the course of getting through our time on Earth, these things are constant. And again, that goes back to the idea of shelter. Where do you gather to either prepare yourself for what's coming or to weather those changes that are really not things that we can control? So yeah, it was very important to me that this not be about Vietnam, but that cyclical nature of suffering that's brought on by things like war and things as simple as our being mortal beings would figure in the novel.
Mm-hmm. And I also, when I read some of the scenes, I thought of Anthony Hecht and his beautiful poem about Jacob. And you and I both had the honor and pleasure of knowing Anthony Hecht.
Yes.
And his poetry is available on the website. He wrote a poem about his experiences, and it was the last recorded interview he did, and it was... He wrote some of his poetry, I felt, kind of resonating in after this, the emotional devastation. And when you named the character Jacob, I thought of Tony fondly, and the listening to his voice read, it was a voice like I would imagine Shakespeare's was.
Yes. Oh, I agree. And I think, again, it's in some ways, I feel I was I'm working against myself in that I chose to set the novel in, you know, what we like to call that tumultuous era of the 60s. As you say, the baby boom cliche, the post-World War II into the mid-70s and all the changes. And certainly I wanted to make use of that, but I did not want that to be the subject of the novel. For me, the subject of the novel, is more the sorts of things that Anthony Hecht writes about, the eternal truth, if I can use such a lofty term.
Mm-hmm.
The eternal truth of our experience on Earth.
Yes. And you're listening to the Casey Kowar Show, A Celebration of Words. Our guest today is Alice McDermott. We're discussing After This, recently published by Farrar, Straus, Giroux. And Alice, one of the things I talked to one of the women at work, Vicky, who read the book and loved it, we were reminiscing about the World's Fair. And there's a wonderful scene with the Pietà in the World's Fair. And I actually went to the World's Fair in 62. And you really brought back a lot of really wonderful memories for, I think, a lot of your readers when you talked about the World's Fair, because it really did change the world.
Well, it did. And again, in the benefit of looking back through time and revisiting those events, at the time, and I certainly have my own, you know, memories of visiting the World's Fair, but it was that marvelously forward-looking, optimistic, it's a great, big, beautiful tomorrow was one of the theme songs, you know.
Mm-hmm.
All that sense. But now looking back from where we are in history now, it has a certain poignancy when you think about... And the scene in the novel is just waiting in a very, very long line to see the Pietà, seeing the Pietà, and that's it. But when you think about when that occurred in history, it was just before Vietnam got bad. One of the ironies of the World Fair that I have in mind but certainly didn't put in the novel simply because sometimes life is too ironic for fiction. In the New York State Pavilion at the World's Fair was the model of the World Trade Center for all of us New Yorkers to look at and marvel at before construction began. So that sense of the optimism of the future, here we were on the cusp of the killing fields of Vietnam, here we were marveling at this model of this remarkable two buildings that would be the tallest in the world that are no longer there now. And again, just the ironies of what it was like living the time and now what it's like to revisit that time and to see the implications of our optimism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's interesting. I hadn't, I wasn't aware that those plans were there. I remember the Unisphere and I can remember flying over it in the 90s thinking, boy, that thing's gone to seed.
Yes, yes. Well, exactly, yeah. Because it was, for the 2 years that it was there, it was a spot of cleans that seemed otherworldly. And worldliness very quickly took over again after it was torn down.
Yeah, yeah. And Alice, one of the things that that I really like about After This is I think it's an important book, and I don't say that lightly, and there's a scene where Claire and Mary, they go see Don Quixote, and Don Quixote is a classic that has stood the test of time, but then there's another scene where Susan and Anne discuss the novels that they have to read, Anna Karenina, Ethan Frome, Madame Bovary. And one of my pet peeves, and one of the things I guess if I could change the world, would be on summer reading tables to change some of the titles that we make our students read in high school and college and update them a bit so that students can learn to love to read. And I think sometimes we burden students with such classics at such a young age that they are turned off to reading.
Sure, yeah.
And I'd like to see some Ann Tyler or some other books make their way onto to some of the tables so that some of the younger people can enjoy the more the relevance maybe of some modern fiction, because there's some great fiction being written right now.
That's true. You know, the two high school girls in the novel, on the other hand, because they had a reading list, have suddenly, I think, in their conversation, find that they have this way of talking about their experience by talking about the literature. I mean, they're making fun of it. They're saying, you know, they're making us read all these books about women who die, you know, Anna Karenina throws herself under a train, Madame Bovary, you know, waste away. Well, it's sex and death. What is this? What are they trying to tell us?
Right.
But at the same time, because they have both had that reading experience, they have almost parallel to what the church does for their parents' generation. That is, give them a language, for things that they wouldn't otherwise have language for. These two girls have a way of speaking to each other about what they're feeling by speaking about these books rather than saying, this just happened to us.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose it's probably a little scene that that shows my faith in literature as a way of giving us a means to talk about things that we might not otherwise have.
Yes. And I by no means want people to think that I don't think people should read the classics. I think they should. But I think they should also read After This and other books.
Definitely.
and put them out on the tables for students to read.
I think you're right. I think the first thing to do is to get young people to love reading and love the experience. And then you can begin to shape their taste, or you can direct them to the better things or the more complex pieces. But first, you got to get them to love the experience of being in a book, which is one of the wonderful things the Harry Potter series has done.
I agree completely. Anytime I see a child with a book in her hand, I get excited.
Exactly. Right. Quality can, you know, you can finesse the quality once they fall in love with reading.
Yeah, because there's so much competition for attention. Alice, if you would share with the listeners a little bit, you published A Bigamous Daughter in 1982, and I have a T-shirt from the Sewanee Writers Conference that says, "Sweetheart, you never tell an author no." And that remains a novel that I really enjoy reading. It has kind of a jazz feel to it. And if you would, you were told early on that that you had some skill as a writer. And if you would share with the listeners what happened to you in your formative years, shall we say?
Well, sure. I went off to college with sort of a vague idea of I think I was going to be a sociology major. Sociology sounded like a college course rather than a high school course. That was
right.
Not as much thought as I'd given it. But in the course of getting a liberal arts degree, I sort of stumbled into a writing class that was taught by Professor Dr. Paul Briand out of Oswego State in New York. And the course was called The Nature of Nonfiction, and we were supposed to write nonfiction, and the first assignment was supposed to have been autobiographical nonfiction. Well, I wrote a story that I completely made up, although I used first-person narrator, and brought it into the class, and the professor read it out. His teaching style was to take our writing and put it on an overhead projector in a theater, so that you didn't have a piece of paper in front of you. You had a screen with your words on it, which made you choose your words rather carefully. So after he had put this little piece of fictional autobiography of mine up on the screen and discussed it, he said to me, I want to talk to you after class. And I was convinced what he was going to say is, this is supposed to be nonfiction, you know, this clearly never happened. And instead, what he said to me is, "I've got bad news for you, kid. You're a writer. Never shake it." And it was one of those moments, you know, one of those wonderful moments in the course of anybody's education when the right teacher at the right time tells you something you've always known and yet never would have known if he hadn't put it into words. And that was my moment.
And Alice, you've been teaching creative writing for a while. We've met at the Suwannee Writers Conference, and in 1998 you published Charming Billy, which won the National Book Award. And how did that change your life, winning the National Book Award? Because I remember you telling me you were genuinely surprised that you won that year.
Oh yes. that was the year Tom Wolfe, A Man in Full, was also nominated, and the buzz was certainly that that's who would get the prize. And I had been nominated for a National Book Award for my second novel that night, so I felt like I already knew the drill of being nominated and not winning, and was honestly very comfortable with that drill. So it was a surprise to find myself having to give an acceptance speech. But I think what happened, the National Book Award certainly got Charming Billy and the rest of my writing probably more attention than it had gotten before. I've always been fortunate to have generous and positive reviews and good attention from reviewers. But, you know, when you're writing small, quiet books about ordinary people, it's hard for them to get the attention that some other works more readily receive. So the National Book Award, and especially the fact that that this quiet little book beat out, as some of the newspapers like to put it, Tom Wolfe's book, again, as if we were in the ring together.
Yeah, and Damascus Gate by Robert Stone as well.
That's right. So there was a story in it. It wasn't just that the book had won a literary award, but there was a story in the winning of it, which again brought more attention to my novel. Other than that, I don't think that the National Book Award made a tremendous difference to me in my work itself. You know, I have not been able to shake the feeling yet every time I begin a new book that I'm a novice. This is my first book. I mean, it's always the first time you're writing this particular story, this particular novel, and it hardly matters that you wrote another because you're starting all over again and attempting to do something you hadn't done before. So, when I'm alone at my desk, the National Book Award means very little. But out in the real world, it was very helpful again in just getting people to pick up the book, to pay a little bit more attention to these quiet stories.
And Alice, what is it that now that after this is done, it's in the stores, what is it that you're happiest about? Because I know you're your own harshest critic and editor of your own work. What are you happiest about with after this?
Oh, my. but yeah, that's a tough one because it's probably easier for me to tell you what I'm unhappy about, but I probably shouldn't do that either. you know, I think what's given me great pleasure is hearing from people, especially readers such as yourself, who maybe understand that although on the surface this is a rather simple story of a rather ordinary family over a familiar few decades, that there are perhaps levels to this story that are unexpected, that there may be more complexity under the surface than a reader might initially assume. It gives me great delight to hear from readers who sort of get it. You know? Not that the book is a puzzle,
right?
but I feel that the book is many, many layered. And I wrote an awful lot that ended up not being included in the novel. This novel did come very slowly, and I wrote many, many scenes, and I know many things about the characters that I chose not to put in. And it's nice to hear that the effect of what's here, although it may be subtle, it may take even a second reading, is reaching my readers. I think I always write with the assumption that my characters, no matter their education or their life experience, are thoughtful and intelligent and striving intellectually, even at their own pace. And assuming that about my characters, I think I'm obliged to certainly assume it about my readers. And so it's very rewarding when people who are not writing PhD theses mm-hmm. on the novel will write to me or call me and say, I understand how that scene operates. I understand how many layers of meaning there are in that single detail.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, that justifies so much. And again, I think if I give that kind of respect to my characters, I have to afford it to my readers as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's I'm glad you said that, because again, I'm not going to give any of the plots away, but I love the ending of After This. To me, it's one of the best endings that I've read in a long time. And in a, like you say, in kind of a quiet family drama, it's hard to end a story in a satisfying manner. And I really think you just nailed the ending on After This. So people that ask, how do you learn how to write, read this book, read it again, and you can save yourself a year or two in a MFA program, because the style is there, and you've long been admired for your style. But I think After This has a depth and a resonance that comes with maturity. And Alice, I really congratulate you on the book, and thank you for taking time to speak with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Casey. It's wonderful to talk to you.
Okay, well, take care, and we'll catch up. I'll probably see you next year at Suwannee.
I hope so.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.